Welcome to Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian Laveau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. One of the most beloved pieces of American literature is Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's 1855 epic poem, The Song of Hiawatha. It was one of the best sellers of its day, and it helped establish the romantic image of Native Americans as a noble and vanishing people that persists to this day. The poem serves as the starting point for a new book on Native Americans written by our guest this week, Alan Trachtenberg. He'll be interviewed by Talking History's John Herron. Following that, Fiona Beattie will tell us about a museum where you can learn more about Native Americans, and Michael Farquhar will offer up the second in his 10-part series drawn from his new book, A Treasury of Deception, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds. But first, as we do every week, let's take a look at an item of historical interest in the news, this one relating to Native Americans. For many Americans, especially Native Americans, the term redskin is a pejorative word that has been used for centuries to disparage and humiliate an entire people. According to an article in the Washington Post, a new study released by a researcher at the Smithsonian Institution makes the case that it did not begin as an insult. Smithsonian linguist Ives Goddard has found that redskin was first used by Native Americans in the 18th century to distinguish themselves from the white other encroaching on their lands. When it first appeared as an English expression in the early 1800s, Goddard explained, it came in the most respectful context and at the highest level. These are white people and Indians talking together, with the white people trying to ingratiate themselves. It was not until July 22, 1815, that redskin first appeared in print in a news story in the Missouri Gazette on talks between Midwestern Indian tribes, an envoy sent by President James Monroe to negotiate treaties after the War of 1812. The envoys had rebuked the tribes for their reluctance to yield territory claimed by the United States, but the Gazette report suggested that Meskwaki, Chief Black Thunder, was unimpressed, replying, "Restrain your feelings and hear calmly what I say. I've never injured you, and innocence can feel no fear. I turn to all redskins and whiteskins and challenge an accusation against me." As you might expect, Goddard's conclusion did not impress Native Americans. Cheyenne Muscogee writer Susan Schoen Harrow, a Native American activist who for the past several years has sought to cancel trademarks covering the name and logo of the Washington Redskins, commented, "I'm very familiar with white men who uphold the judicious speech of white men. Europeans were not using high-minded language. To them, we were only human when it came to territory, land sessions, and whose side you were on." Historians have raised questions concerning Goddard's work as well. Hiram Hover, for example, in one of his blogs, pointed to the difficulty of translating statements from other languages into English and of the danger of not placing the use of such terms into the wider context of demeaning representations of Native Americans, which often came combined with references to their skin color well before the 19th century. Hover also reminded his readers that the Washington Redskins did not acquire that name from linguists familiar with 17th and 18th century Native languages. When we return, we continue on the subject of Native Americans with our guest, Alan Trachtenberg. This is Talking History. Talking History's John Herron recently sat down with Yale University's Alan Trachtenberg to discuss his new book, Shades of Hiawatha, Staging Indians, Making Americans, 1880 to 1930. Here is what they had to say.
From the moment of contact, white Americans have tried to understand the culture of the native peoples they encountered. This now centuries-long effort has been marked by accommodation, misunderstanding, certain violence, and even irony. For as Indian wars continued to rage over much of the Great Plains in the late 19th century, Americans embraced a romantic image of Indians as a noble and vanishing people. And as our guest this week illustrates, the contradictory images of native peoples highlights a persistent struggle over the question of just what it means to be an American. Alan Trachtenberg is the Neil Gray Jr. Professor Emeritus of English and American Studies at Yale University. His books include The Incorporation of America, Reading American Photographs, and Brooklyn Bridge Fact and Symbol. His latest work is Shades of Hiawatha, Staging Indians, Making Americans, 1880 to 1930, published in 2004 by Hill and Wang. Welcome, Alan.
Thank you.
Determining national identity has been a theme of much of your earlier work. Why don't you lead us into this story? What questions brought you to this project?
Well, I think that there are a number of factors. To begin with, on a personal level, I believe anyone, for example, who reads the novels of Philip Roth will recognize that a child of an immigrant family would almost inevitably be born with such questions about identity in regard to the nation on his lips. My own interests growing up in school turned toward literature and especially toward American writers, and especially those writers for whom the question of the identity and the meaning of the American were a foremost concern. Figures like Walt Whitman and, in the 20th century, Hart Crane, who served as a focal point for my first book called Brooklyn Bridge, Fact and Symbol. In a book that I wrote in the it appeared in the early 80s called The Incorporation of America, I came to focus more specifically on the question of various and conflicting meanings about the identity of the nation, or perhaps better put, the meaning of the nation to particular groups within the country as a whole. And the Incorporation of America tried especially to say that in the period after the Civil War, there were essentially two major ideas that came into collision with each other. One was an old idea that goes back to the Revolutionary era, which is the notion of union. Of course, the notion of union had a great deal to do with the sources of the Civil War itself, which, from the point of view of the Northern position, was fought for the sake of preserving the Union, maintaining it, furthering it as a fundamental principle of the nation as a whole. The victory of the Union side, however, also gave rise to a great deal of energetic business activity, which took a new form, a new invented form within American life that is known as the corporation. And what I try to do in that book is to examine what ideas of the nation as a whole these two terms, corporation and union, represented and how they stood in relationship to each other. When it comes to the current book, Shades of Hiawatha, I'm looking at this question in a slightly later period, the turn of the century, from the late 1880s through the First World War and the 1920s, mm-hmm. and looking at it also from a somewhat different perspective, really from the point of view of, you could say, ethnicity, racial difference, the notion of what constitutes the actual physical as well as mental and emotional characteristics of a figure that we might call the typical or the authentic American.
Right, right. Well, your late 19th century setting then for Shades of Hiawatha is indeed very familiar. I mean, the amount of change caused by urbanization and industrialization and immigration is certainly well documented. Speaking of ethnicity, the main ethnic group you chronicle in Shades of Hiawatha, obviously Native Americans, are almost always ignored. But you see Indians as critical to the social transformations in this area. Why is that?
Well, it's hard to say that they're actually critical to the transformation of society that's occurring in this very, very critical period, a period when the main engine of transformation really is industry and business organization, the process that I call in my earlier book and that other scholars, of course, call incorporation, the emergence of large-scale industry and organizations that are based upon financial arrangements for the control of industry. But Native Americans, who had nothing to do really and were not part of that process, Native Americans, I think, became critical to the changes in that era in yet another way. They were critical in the way in which the agencies of consciousness, we might say, in the era, attempted to understand what was happening in American life in the face of its vast changes that are, as I say, most visibly represented by the expansion of the nation westward, by the pushing forward of the railroad, and by the emergence of large-scale industrial enterprises. The Native Americans represented at this time the most alien groups within the United States, more so even than immigrant groups, which were beginning to arrive in large numbers by the late 1880s. But the alienness of the Native Americans, even more so than of the African Americans, because African Americans had already been in many ways acculturated, speaking English, familiar with the systems and the forms of education and of social behavior within mainstream white society. Native Americans, with languages of their own, approximately some 500 separate languages among the vast number of different tribal groups who constituted the native population, the indigenous population at this time, speaking a different language, representing a different skin color, seeming to be completely outside of the expectations of American society, as I said, gave forth the appearance and impression of alienness in a very direct and, for many people, menacing way. Yet they were the natives. They were the indigenous population. And some people would also use the expression, they are indeed the first Americans. How can they be both first Americans and non-Americans at the same time? Part of my book discusses what many other scholars have also focused on, the process whereby government agencies as well as private philanthropic groups in this period from the 1880s through the turn of the century attempted to resolve that contradiction by developing programs that were designed to, so to speak, Americanize these so-called first Americans, to make American Indians into model Americans, which is to say Americans according to the model of the mainstream middle-class society, property owners, individuals who are respectful of the processes of self-advancement through education, through prudential saving of resources, and so on. Such ideas were in serious violation, or at least in opposition, to inherited patterns of social life on the part of the natives. For example, the common practice of communal ownership of land and communal relations in the way of mutual aid that were true of tribal social forms. And so the process of change had to be severe if it was to have any effect. This is the time when the United States government supported and sponsored a number of what were known as boarding schools, in which young Indians were removed from their parents, removed from their tribal circumstances, which by now was primarily throughout the country circumstances that were defined by the term reservation, that is, fixed places of residence rather than merely locales within which their people would wander looking for superior hunting grounds during the course of the year, taken from these fixed residential areas called reservations, removed many hundreds of miles to schools, the most famous of which was the Carlisle School in Pennsylvania, where they would undergo a process of education that was designed to produce in them the model American. Now, the effect of this on the social transformations going on in this era, I think we're not immediate, not direct, not wholesale, but from the point of view of the symbolic implication of these absolutely alien figures transformed into the perfect examples of what the modern American was meant to be,
right.
I think the influence was strong and widespread.
Well, the platform for your narrative is Henry Longfellow's epic poem in 1855, The Song of Hiawatha. And you mentioned that this poem was enormously popular, on par with best-selling contemporary novels like Uncle Tom's Cabin. What is it about that poem? What was the appeal?
Well, I think maybe the first appeal of The Song of Hiawatha is its meter. It's such an easy poem to memorize. And the language of the poem also has a certain magical quality. It describes a time which is out of history, a timeless time, let us say, a time and a place. The place actually can be located more or less in the northwest regions of the country around the Great Lakes, specifically the lake that's known as Gichigumi in the poem, or Lake Superior. But still, that descriptive pattern of language that defines the place is more or less vague. We're transported to a realm that is out of place and out of time. And there's something magical about this and of great appeal. We see the birth of the young hero, Hiawatha. We witness his childhood. We watch him grow up and learn how to be a hunter. We learn from him what the necessities of tribal life are. He engages in battles with various exotic creatures. And then finally, at the end of the poem, I should not forget, of course, the extraordinary marriage scene. That is, he weds in the poem to Minnehaha, and that's a colossal event in itself. But toward the end of the poem, he's still in his prime. He's not yet an old man. He has evidence that another kind of people has arrived. He sees the foot, that is a footprint, of the white man, and comes to realize that the time of the Indian has passed. And so he has a session with his people in which he tells them that their days are finished, that he no longer has a mission among them, that he must leave, and he advises them to look toward these new figures, the white people, especially those in the black robes, the priests, for their counsel, for their leadership. And he puts himself into a canoe and pushes off and goes into the setting sun. So he's a very compliant Indian. If the white population, the Euro-American population, so to speak, imagined that Indians were a vanishing race, The Song of Hiawatha both gave evidence of this by demonstrating that Hiawatha must disappear at the end, and at the same time made that act of disappearance, that act of vanishing, a pathetic event. So there is a sentimental emotion attached to this allegedly historical event of the disappearance, the vanishment of the native population. I think that's one way of looking at the enormous appeal of the poem.
The poem strikes a very responsive chord in contemporary America. I mean, its themes were everywhere, it seemed, from grade school performances to operas, theater, paintings, and even as you chronicle an early 20th century translation into Yiddish. What's the link, or is there a link between the Jewish immigrant experience and something like The Song of Hiawatha?
Well, I doubt that there was any specific link. I think the translation of the poem into Yiddish was primarily a choice of the poet. His name was Yehoash, or Solomon Blumgarten. Yehoash was his nom de plume. And the very famous literary critic who wrote an introduction to the poem, which dealt with the question of the importance of translation. Both Yehoash and the critic, whose name was Jutlovsky, believed that one way in which Jews, a people without a homeland of their own, but a people who have found in the United States something they had been looking for hundreds of years, and that is a society, a political society that would accept them on a basis of equality and not require that they convert and certainly not persecute them in destructive ways because of their religious differences. The poet and the translator felt that the next step beyond political equality would be a cultural familiarity on the part of immigrant Jews with the hospitable culture, the dominant culture of the society, American culture, best embodied in American writing. So the choice was to take a poem, which is extremely popular, and to make it available to readers of Yiddish. How successful that was, I really can't say. I don't know how widely read that Yiddish translation was. The point is that Jutlovsky, the critic I'm referring to, was committed to trying to keep the language of Yiddish alive. Most of the population of immigrant Jews, I think, had another commitment, which was to learn the new language, the home language of English, American English. And so there was, in some senses, a losing battle implied by the translation of Longfellow's poem into Yiddish. As far as I know, that translation never went beyond the first edition.
Right.
I think it had an appeal to intellectuals and to other poets, rather than a mass appeal.
Right.
As I point out in the book, Hiawatha becomes, in popular culture, on the Lower East Side, especially in New York, Hiawatha becomes a kind of comic figure. And we find vestiges of the kind of laughs that can be generated by portraying an Indian figure in film or on the stage who suddenly breaks into Yiddish. We think of Blazing Saddles and other films mm-hmm. in which this occurs.
Well, we just have time for one more last question. And by looking at some of these debates about citizenship and national identity, do you feel like you're proposing a kind of a new creation story for America?
Well, I do use that term, creation story. It's a term that I take from a contemporary Choctaw novelist named Leon Howe, who does suggest that one future in the relations between Euro-Americans and Native Americans is to find a common basis in a shared historical identity. And there are many, many ways in which this can be done. The history of those relations, of course, are filled with anguish as well as anger, and a lot of bloodshed. But there's also another history of positive interaction, certainly a history of enormous indebtedness on the part of the newly arrived Euro-Americans or newly arrived immigrants going back to the 17th century, learning from very hospitable native peoples and native cultures how to survive on this continent, what the fruits of the land were, how to make your way in the forests, what the sea could deliver in the way of food, and so on. So there is a basis, I think, of a new tribal creation story, tribal in the broad sense of the United States as a whole.
Thank you, Alan. This has been a fascinating discussion. You have been listening to Alan Trachtenberg, author of Shades of Hiawatha, Staging Indians, Making Americans, published by Helen Wang.
As a follow-up to our interview with Alan Trachtenberg, we've chosen for our site of the week a museum where you can learn much more about Native Americans. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Fiona Beattie.
Its exterior walls are clad in limestone, giving it the appearance of a rock face worn over time by wind and water. Situated near the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C., on over 4 acres of land, the National Museum of the American Indian is hailed as stunning in its architectural appeal. It was George Gustav Heye who, at the beginning of the 20th century, began collecting a wide range of indigenous art. Pottery, masks, hides, basketry, from many regions. This, along with other collections, was until recently housed in the former Museum of the American Indian in New York City. Since opening in late 2004, the new museum's 4 permanent exhibitions have shown visitors how traditional indigenous knowledge continues to be relevant and how, over the past 500 years of struggle, native peoples have consciously kept their cultures alive. 2 exhibits focus on the contemporary, the lives and identities of people living in 8 native communities, and an art exhibit, Native Modernism, featuring the work of George Morrison and Alan House. The museum's website provides 21 online exhibits, ranging from a virtual museum tour, basket weaving, native ranching and rodeo life on the plains and plateaus, to an exploration of Indian humor. And for those inclined to audio, there are 2 half-hour radio programs, The Legacy of Maidu Indian Artist Frank Day and Coyote Bites Back, Indian Humor, available by downloading from American Indian Radio Satellite. To explore the site for yourself, or to get more information on the National Museum of the American Indian, go to www.nmai.si.gov. edu.
And finally, we continue our series of readings with Michael Farquhar's new book, A Treasury of Deception, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds. Farquhar is a writer and editor for The Washington Post. And this week, he selected a piece titled The Sun Promises the Moon from part two of his book, All the News That's Slipped to Print.
The New York Sun's six-part moon series was perhaps the most successful hoax in newspaper history. Thousands were taken in by the paper's fantastic tales of exotic life on Earth's nearest neighbor, and the sun circulation became the largest in the world. The series, which began in August of 1835, was relatively restrained at first, which set a tone of pseudoscientific credibility. It was reported that Sir John Herschel, son of the famed astronomer Sir William Herschel, had sailed to South Africa with a newly developed telescope that was capable of focusing on the moon with incredible clarity. The mechanics of the huge instrument were described in dry academic detail, which almost lulled the reader into believing the bombshells that were to come. The installment that followed tantalized readers with glimpses of the lunar landscape and its inhabitants. There were beaches with brilliant white sand, rocks of green marble, and forests like none seen on Earth. Buffalo-like creatures roamed the endless plains, and another strange animal was described as being bluish in color, with a head and beard like a goat and a single horn. The images became more and more vivid in subsequent installments. The sun described vast lakes and oceans, abandoned temples of emerald, and a beaver-like creature with no tail that stood upright on 2 feet, carried its young like a human, and even knew how to make fire. Having seduced readers thus far, the paper revealed the most sensational discovery of all. The moon, it declared, was inhabited by several species of human-like creatures with long, semi-transparent wings, batmen of sorts who lived in complete harmony, feasted off the land, and had lots and lots of sex. The Sun's Moon hoax was a smash. New Yorkers devoured the story, snatching up installments as fast as they were printed. The presses were run at full capacity for 10 hours a day, and still the demand couldn't be satisfied. The New York Times called the revelations probable and plausible, and even in academic circles there was genuine belief in the moon discoveries. It's tempting to think that people were incredibly gullible in 1835, but it must be remembered that this was an era of amazing scientific and technological advances, and almost anything seemed possible, including life on the moon.
You've been listening to Michael Farquhar reading from his new book, A Treasury of Deception, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds, published by Penguin Books. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beatty is our producer, and Alex Smith our studio engineer. That the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu, or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thanks for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.